Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Scott Hoag, and with me is my co-host, Tom Coffeen. Ed is out of pocket today, but today we're going to talk about IPv6 security, my favorite subject, with our guest, Eric Venk from Cisco. I'd like to give you a brief introduction on Eric. Eric has worked for Cisco since 1997, 22 years. He's a distinguished engineer. He's authored a couple of Cisco press books, which I recommend you read. One of my favorites, LAN Switch Security, What Hackers Know About Your LAN Switches. And my favorite book, IPv6 Security. Eric is also CTO and co-chair of the Belgium IPv6 Council. He's been involved in the IETF for many years, authoring several RFCs. So let's just jump right in and start off with some questions. So Eric, just finished Cisco Live Europe in Barcelona. What sessions did you teach and kind of any new IPv6 things happen there?
So basically in Europe and Barcelona, and by the way, thank you, Scott, for the nice introduction. And I also like this IPv6 security book because my co-author was quite famous and quite friendly. Besides this... private joke. We have many F2 sessions in Europe Cisco Live. We did for the first time a four-hour dedicated technical seminar dedicated to security. So spending 4 hours just on IPv6 security. So looking about the first hop security, the rogue array, the mitigation techniques among all those layer 2, layer 3 attack. What about extension headers? We play with SCAPI in order to generate a very specific IPv6 packets and see how they go through firewalls and routers and switches, so on and so on. And then I got my 2 hours usual breakout on advanced IPv6 security that, by the way, will be repeated in San Diego in June. So feel free to attend this IPv6 advanced security. It's 2 hours. We talk about first hop security, not only the threat, because now I guess everyone knows about this rogue array attack, but more about the mitigation techniques. What are the different roles that a device can play in first hop security, whether it's a host, whether it's a switch, whether it's a router, which is a server. A lot of things regarding extension headers, because I think it's still a major and critical part of IPv6 security. And also the usual user attribution. So basically, I got a V6 address, but who was the user behind it? Maybe because he did something wrong, or maybe his configuration is strange or weird or misconfigured, and we need to fix it. So it's basically the taking there both the security officer point of view as well as the network manager's point of view.
Yeah, you pronounce it SCAPI. I pronounce it SCAPI as well, not SCAPI, even though it's a Python packet crafting library. Any of our listeners may be interested in exploring that, because it's a great way to test creating IPv4 or IPv6 crafted packets. There recently was a RFC written about IPv6 security attribution, or maybe it's still a draft. But yeah, that's an interesting topic to cover as well. Since our book, you know, was written maybe 10 years ago, maybe give us an update. How's the landscape for security changed, or what is it like today?
Oh, I must say, Scott, that what we wrote about in the 10 or even nearly 11 years ago now, is still correct at 90-95%, because we lay out on the fact that IPv6 is pretty much like IPv4, right? So it's connectionless network layer, running on the same data link layer and using the same transport protocol above TCP and UDP and so on. So based on this, I think our book is still the same. A few things has evolved, specifically as we know more about attacks around fragmentation and everything playing with extension headers. That was covered in the book, but not in so much detail. So it's still the fact that IPv6 and IPv4 security are the same for 95%. I mean, denial of service are the same, flooding attack are the same. Of course, all the attack at the layer 2, for instance, of a Wi-Fi network, doesn't care whether it's V4 or V6. And the same thing, if you do something at the application layer, let's say WordPress has got an issue or PHP has got an issue, of course, whether it's run over V4 or V6, it doesn't matter. So yeah, the landscape of security has changed somehow since our book, mainly around extension headers, but it's still very identical to V4, but we need to take care about, you know, the 1-5% difference between both, because that's very different.
Yeah, Eric, if you could expand on that a little bit. We know that there's a bit of a delta between IPv4 and IPv6 security. I mean, if you're an enterprise network operator, what's the critical part of that delta that you should be looking at and be aware of?
I would say there are two differences between V4 and V6, no surprise. One is about the addressing, not so much about the addressing structure. I mean, it deserves a podcast on its own, but more about the way hosts get the addresses. Because in IPv4, it's mainly the HTTP, and with the HTTP V4, you know exactly the link between the MAC address and the IPv4 list address. It's not the case in V6, even if you're using the HTTP V6, because an IPv6 address, or actually addresses, because you can get multiple V6 addresses from the HTTP V6, link to the DHCP unique ID, what we call the DUID. And this DUID is unique per host. So even if you have multiple interfaces, like Wi-Fi and its MAC address, Ethernet and its MAC address, Bluetooth and its MAC address, 3GPP with its own link layer address, you end up using the same DHCP unique ID. So sometimes you do not know which is the MAC address associated to a V6 address, even using DHCP. And of course, if you go into the privacy extension, it's becoming very tricky to find the link. I mean, we can talk about this later, as you know, because there are ways of doing it, because, of course, we need to manage your network. But the other part is really about the extension headers. There are ways to escape some security connectionless or stateless, let's say, access control list by fragmenting packets in a very weird ways. Now, normally, and I think most of the hosts in 2019 refuse those very weird fragmented packets. So basically, that's where the extension header chain is fragmented itself. So basically, the TCP and UDP ports are into the second fragment. So when a stateless access control list or a stateless firewall, so let's say a router or switch, I don't think about stateful firewall, receive the second fragment, it doesn't know where to find the port because this information was in the first fragment, which of course, being stateless, you forget about it. So that's a real issue. That's the reason why RFC 8200 from the IETF, which standardized IPv6 from last year, specifies that host should discard those kind of really fragmented packets because they may or most probably contain an IPv6 attack. So that's kind of okay. But now we still have the issue, for instance, in some devices. For instance, if you think about my own employer, Cisco, we got many, many kind of switches and access points and routers. And based upon the hardware, sometimes we can go 64 bytes deep into the extension header to find the TCP or UDP ports, or we can go to 128 or 256, but it's changed from device to device. And I'm pretty sure there's the same thing in other vendors as well. That's the reason why I come back to SCAPI, and I fully second Scott on this. Using SCAPI with your own equipment to check is there any performance impact or whether this device can go deep enough into the extension header to find the TCP and UDP port and what's behaving after. That's really key. Very difficult to find information. Shame on the industry on this. So basically, that's the landscape is the same as a PV4, except addressing. So or we can find the user behind the V6 address and all those extension headers.
Yeah, Tom has written and presented on DHCP V6 fingerprinting. And we've spoken about some of the issues around the DHCP V6 unique identifier that hosts have. One thing I realized recently is that Windows hosts use the same DUID for many of their interfaces. And the DUID comes from the Ethernet port on the laptop. And so if the laptop is joining wireless and the DUID is link layer plus time, the DUID that's used on the wireless includes the DUID from the Ethernet port, which uses the Ethernet's MAC address. So on a wireless network, if you're trying to track down hosts on wireless with DUID and trying to do that attribution you just talked about, you're tracking down a DUID with the MAC address of an Ethernet port, yet it's on a wireless network. So DUIDs can be operationally problematic and difficult for when it comes to forensics.
Absolutely. And the other point as well is that you cannot pre-provision a DHCP server to write on a specific DUID because you don't know it yet. It's typically time of the first boot plus indeed a MAC address, but you don't know which MAC address and you know the time, of course, of the first boot of the device. It's not really linked to security, this kind of pre-provisioning, but it doesn't help a PV6 case, that's for sure. So it's basically, I think, the DHCP will lose its leading edge here. And we need to rely really on Slack and Privacy Extension and use stuff like we call first stop security. It's basically using all the savvy protocols from the IETF that keep tracks of the MAC address and the V6 address by using multiple means. For instance, first packet, we see we consider the mapping is correct. First talker wins, basically.
Savvy, for our listeners, is the Source Address Validation Improvements Working Group in the IETF, which takes a lot of this functionality, security functionality that a cable modem termination system, a CMTS, or a DSLAM implement to prevent broadband internet access attacks and make sure those systems work well and there isn't attacks from subscriber to subscriber. So implementing those same types of techniques into wireless end controllers or access switches that an enterprise can use that then helps prevent security issues there. So yeah, Source Address Validation Improvements, SAVI.
Exactly.
So what are other operational considerations for IPv6 security? What are other issues there?
Regarding operation, I think it's mainly about getting the right access control list. And again, that's because addressing can change. For instance, if you have a server, by default, it will build up a static V6 address plus dynamic privacy extension address. But the static IPv6 address, previously based on the MAC address, but now it's based on the random but static number, it's difficult to enter both in the DNS and in access control list. So there are a few things about getting really host-by-host access control list in IPv6, that's an issue, and the user attribution. And that's really where all the locks and all the transaction from either, if you're using, for instance, .1x, and you can have a mapping between the user of .1x and the MAC address and the IPv6 address by using most of the .1x switch or access point, which is pretty cool.
Eric, I had a question related to something we consider the latent threat of IPv6, and this is specifically in the case where most enterprises that really haven't taken the step to deploy IPv6 internally to the desktop, they're running essentially IPv4 only networks. Of course, the hosts have happily configured themselves with IPv6 addresses that are only significant on the link, but still there's the possibility for nefarious activity. And we've seen time and again that enterprise admins aren't necessarily paying attention to this latent threat, even if they might have read about it or be aware of it in a cursory way. We know we have some first hop security features in IPv4. Is the landscape for how those work in IPv6 exactly the same to the point where an enterprise admin can just enable both and feel some security that latent threat has been dealt with?
So there are basically two points, right, I think, in your question, Tom. Both points are pretty valid. The first time when I'm talking to either security officer or network manager about the latent threat, because basically what defines an IPv6 network is not an IPv6 enabled or configured router or access point, but it's IPv6 enabled endpoint. So basically all the Mac and the Windows and the Android and the iPhones of the world. So everyone is running basically a V6 network and can be attacked locally over IPv6. So typically when I explain this to customers, I see blank face. And sometimes, really, because, they understand the issue. And sometimes as well, I see people, they got the stars in their eyes because they understand now what kind of strange stuff was happening in their network. For instance, they do an IPv4 only access control list to prevent some replication or some traffic between two Windows machines, for instance. And they see the traffic is still going through, even if the access control list was assumed to block it because the ICL was V4 and the traffic was going V6, as you know. Yeah. I mean, for all of us and our listener, it's pretty obvious what was happening. But then you see this guy, big eyes. So, yeah. And in some case, I see multiple reaction. I mean, the first thing they say, hey, I will disable V6. Good luck, right? Because first, as we all know, Microsoft, you lose your support if you disable V6. But it's too complex to do it. And it's way better to assume V6 is there, either go dual stack or V6 only, but at least deploy the V6 security feature. And you were perfectly right. That's the second point. We do have, I think, talking, of course, what I know for the Cisco devices, but I'm pretty sure the industry as well has the same level of security on switches. So in Cisco, we talk in IPv4 about dynamic app inspection and DHCP snooping. So basically learning through the HTTP, the binding between the IP and the MAC, and then enforcing through ARP inspection the good reply and queries about over ARP. We do the same thing in IPv6. It's called first-stop security, or it's called IPv6 object tracking. very much the same thing. The only thing is that we just talked before, DHCPv6 is not the only way to get an IPv6 address. We use Slack and privacy extension, so we needed to get more gleaning mechanisms. So to fill up the table mapping the correct MAC address with the correct v6 address, and maybe the end user if you're using .1x behind it. So that's there. And what we have done, we have as well, we've written completely the IPv4 ways and configuring this first top security for IPv4 to match the same CLI as IPv6. So now you can configure very easily a dual stack first top security so that a host cannot steal an IPv6 address or an IPv4 address within the same LAN or the same VLAN there. So that's something that really people need to consider. And again, you were alluding to my book about switch security. It's something that is 15 years old now. Mm-hmm. And we were already talking about V6 there. And now we got the techniques, we got the product. And I say we again, it's not only Cisco, I think this is industry.
Yeah, good point. I mean, people get upset about when they first learn about the IPv6 neighbor discovery protocol vulnerabilities, and they fail to realize that those same vulnerabilities exist in their IPv4 ARP networks today. They've taken no steps to harden any of their V4 infrastructure. So don't get upset at IPv6 because you haven't taken care of something today, you know, but many people often, yeah, they don't realize that link local addresses are used by every device and they haven't taken any steps to either familiarize themselves with how it works or gain visibility to how it works or to, like you said, you could be in a much more advantageous position by enabling IPv6, controlling it, applying your, you know, corporate security policies to IPv6, then you'd be less fearful of it and more in control and more intentional about it.
Absolutely, Scott. And sometimes, for instance, at Cisco Live, when explained about all the V6 security issue at this kind of mix between the layer 2 and layer 3, people say, but it's not doable, I will never deploy it, and blah, 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 blah. Then I ask, have you done something for IPv4? Maybe one-third of the people upset with the V6 were doing something about V4. So there's no point to need to protect V6 if you do not protect IPv4 or vice versa. You need really to be congruent. You need to apply the same level of paranoia. And again, it depends upon the use case, whether you want to secure this layer 2, layer 3 binding there. And by the way, while we talk about this latent threat, it's not only about, you know, mitigating an attack, but it's also about discovering what kind of weaknesses you have in your security policy. For instance, most of the enterprise network I know are scanning the complete IPv4 prefix. I mean, this RFC 1918 prefix, they do it daily to discover all the active IPv4 addresses, doing by simple ping. And then they are doing post-scanning to see what kind of server, is it a web server or a SIP proxy or whatever. But you need to do the same thing if you want to be consistent with V6 as well. But then, how can you scan even a slash 64 prefix in IPv6? That's no way, right? So there, my advice is basically to use the neighbor cache, all the routers and switches. Again, first top security will give you this by SNMP or by gRPC and telemetry. So you will get all the V6 addresses or IPFIX and NetFlow. So you know the list of active V6 addresses in your network. And then you can do the scanning. And you need to scan the ports for V4 and V6 mostly at the same time. Because if one port is open on IPv4 and not over V6, something is read because the attacker will attack you on the V4 or vice versa, obviously. Now, there are some ports that only need to be open in IPv4 and some only in IPv6. For instance, V4 and V6 are DHCP using different ports as far as I know. But then if you want to do reconnaissance, right, so basically get the inventory, it's not enough to use what I said, first top security and IPv6 on NetFlow. Because all your hosts and all your VM in your data centers has got V6 enabled by default. And they could be attacked by another VM or host in the data center, which is on the same VLAN. So if you really want to be paranoid, and again, it depends upon your use case, you should have a listener and basically a port scanning using link local addresses as well. So it means that the scanner needs to be in all the VLAN in your data center, which may or may not be feasible, though.
So, Eric, you've been involved in the Belgium IPv6 Council, and last summer you gave a talk titled what can be done with IPv6? And you mentioned some really interesting things there about some unique characteristics of IPv6. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about those topics?
Yeah, it is basically topics that we started in Cisco and into the what we call the Paris Innovation and Research Lab, where we had last year about 5 to 10 people working just on what can we do with V6 that we cannot do in IPv4. And it's basically linked about the extension headers and the addresses. For instance, we have so many V6 addresses that we can, in a single /64, address all what we call the video chunks of all the movies worldwide. As you know, by looking at Netflix or YouTube, a movie can be in different resolution and is basically cut in very small piece we call video chunks or video segments, which duration is between 1 and 10 seconds. It basically allows you to scan and browse very quickly through the complete movie without downloading the complete movie. So each and every 2-3 seconds of the movie has got a different URI on YouTube, for instance, and based on the resolution as well, whether it's low resolution or high definition, you get another URI. But that's a URI, right? So basically, that's where in the path that you define, this is the segment I want and the resolution. So we took the idea, what about using a few bits into a V6 address to define the duration? What about the few bits to say the sequence number? Is it the first or the last one? And what about using a few bits for the language of the movie, for instance, and a few bits about the resolution? Is it high def or low def? More bits, about 30 bits, basically, to define which movie is it. And with this, we got a complete addressing scheme. The beauty of it, we can now address a single segment of 2-3 seconds uniquely by a V6 address. Why do we want to do this? Simply because now you find the content based on the layer 3 information. Even if the upper layer is encrypted by TLS, for instance, you can still use CDN using routing, like Anycast, or CDN using OSPF or CMP for doing some load balancing, as well as doing some accounting and analytics based on the V6 address, so based on NetFlow IPFix. So it provided a huge amount of advantage there. If the listener of this podcast wants to check, or if you or Tom want to check, you can go to the website called 6cn.io, so 6contentnetworking.io, to get some demonstration of movies there. And you can even upload your own movies. And each of 2-3 seconds of your movie will get a very unique V6 address that will stay for a while. I mean, until this website is taken down. Now, how can we get a device to know whether it will need to use this path or this path? And this is where an effort that Cisco is leading with people from Google, Deutsche Telekom, as well as Apple, is what we call the provisioning domain. And that's a draft at the IETF, and I hope to get it as an RFC before the end of this year. This is where, when we are sending route advertisement, we can send within the route advertisement more information about the provisioning domain, as we call it. So every provisioning domain will have a fully unique name, which is a DNS name, by the way, where we link together the prefix to be used by the host, the DNS recursive servers, and the next hop and other information. Because we really want those three pieces of information to be used consistently as a bundle. Because there's no point, for instance, in the world where we are living right now, where I guess, Scott and Tom, your phone is currently connected over 3GPP as well as Wi-Fi. So they got 2 V6 addresses. So it needs to use a V6 address of 2GPP to go through the DNS server of 3GPP. And if an application like the web browser wants to go to a newspaper website, it needs to select 1 V6 address, the one received from the 3GPP DNS server or from the Wi-Fi DNS server, but then consistently use the right interface to go for the content. Most probably you know how, for instance, how you roam. So, Scott, if you are in your country, doesn't care too much whether you use your 3GPP US address or Wi-Fi US address to go to your US newspaper. But if you go, for instance, to Europe, and you are more than welcome to join my own country and Belgium and get a beer over there, if you ask your 3GPP, you will get an IPv6 address from US, you will go to a DNS resolver, and you will get the CDN address of your newspaper based in US. While if you go over Wi-Fi, you will go to a Wi-Fi DNS server. In Belgium, you will get an IPv6 address of the CDN in Belgium. So far, so good. But now, if you are using, once you get this V6 address in Belgium, you are using your 3GPP and roaming, very expensive, to go 3GPP through US and back to Belgium CDN server, you will pay a lot and you will be a very bad performance. So basically, we need to make a bundle of this. It's not so much linked to V6. It's an issue with multi-homing. But with V6, we have a very nice way to solve the problem with the provisioning domain sent into the route advertisement. I understand it's a quite tricky thing. You may want to look for provisioning domain over the internet and get more information, because I think that's something that's really, really important. It needs to be done in IPv6 as well as in IPv4.
Yeah, fascinating. And you've mentioned a couple things in the course of the last answer related to some of the innovation that can happen with V6. And that's exciting to hear, because we get on the podcast, we're often bogged down in enterprise land where the V6 deployments are pretty immature, just, you know, not there's not that much deployed. And it's great to sort of hear more of the things that are possible to do with V6.
And by the way, regarding the enterprise, and sorry to interrupt you, Tom, it's another area that I forget to mention is all the area of containers. So the Dockers and so on, where we can give with V6 a unique IPv6 address per container. So we don't need to do all those mapping of ports and all the provisioning of this mapping of ports for each and every container. But even more important, you can put into the V6 address of the container ID itself or the process ID. So, and if you use this once and then you throw the V6 address away, in your logs, you can say that, oh, this IPv6 address was used on this server, right? Because you get the leading 64-bit, for instance. And it was at that point of time, because you put the date into the V6 address, and on this process ID. So you can make correlation between any kind of application log or system logs on your actual servers, the containers, and the V6 address. So that's also helping a lot regarding audit in the container world.
Absolutely. That's incredibly powerful. To bring up another topic related to the number of V6 DDoS attacks that we've seen sort of over the last several years, and we've seen them increasing, you know, more frequency, and then the volume of the attacks seems to be getting larger. And of course, it's no surprise that last year we saw the largest one so far of all, and it's likely that that trend will continue. But I guess my question for you would be, you know, what should organizations be doing to protect themselves against V6 DDoS attacks?
Pretty much like they do in IPv4. I mean, if you are an enterprise customer, you can do very little things regarding volume-based DDoS, right? It's only the service provider that can do something there. There are techniques like scrubbing traffic, so basically rerouting by using routing protocols like BGP. Reroute the traffic to your site via a scrubbing device, and also very big CDNs are happy to do it for you as well. So same thing. There's also techniques called remote triggered black hole, RTBH, also relying on BGP, where you can block traffic from a prefix or from a V6 address, or basically as well redirect all the traffic from one of your web properties to a black hole. So basically saving your other web properties for a while. And this RTBH system is using typically what you call the discard prefix. Again, it's a BGP trick. And funny enough, the IATF has standardized the discard prefix for this role in RSC 6666. So, right, 666 is the numbers of the beast for IPv6. So I really love to work for the IATF. Sometimes they got very nice acronyms. For instance, a working group to be formed is called ROM, R-U-M. Okay. I guess they will get a drink when they finish. But
yeah.
And this kind of, so basically, yeah, DDoS had arrived there. I remember in 2011 or 2012, Cisco.com got its first IPv6 DDoS. And it was, I mean, a couple of emails within Cisco meaning, hey, we got our first DDoS. Actually, we were proud and happy with it. Because it's a sign of maturity, right? If you are attacked over V6 somehow. But it was 10 meg.
Oh, yeah. Tiny.
So we still wonder whether it's an attack or somebody downloading something of a very fast link. But it's a different story.
Yeah, that reminds me of the day when I was working for Limelight as the CDN, and at the time we were delivering the Microsoft Tuesday patch, and inevitably there'd be some poor enterprise, you know, customer over a T1 or a fractional T1, we're being DDoSed. It's like, no, it's just your Tuesday update.
Exactly, that's basically the same thing. And you notice as well that Steam, you know, the big gaming for Windows and maybe other platform, is also using IPv6 now to download all the updates. And when we know the updates are all the maps and the graphics, that can be huge over V6. Mm-hmm. So interesting to see. It's recent, it's a couple of weeks ago. So we still need to get the numbers of it.
Yeah. Wow. This has been a tremendous show, Eric. I really appreciate you giving us some of your valuable time and sharing with us these great insights on IPv6 security. Unlike IPv6, though, we've run out of space for this podcast. So thanks to today's guest, Eric Bank. Thank you. Eric, please tell our audience how they could follow you on the internet, find out other things that you're working on or other things you're writing or presenting.
Thank you for the invitation. So basically, I'm not a big Twitter fan, but I tweet sometimes. So my handle is basically evinky. So E like Eric and Vinky like my last name. You can go as well to ving.org and you type /IPv6 status. That's basically where I keep statistics about V6 deployment for more than 10 years now. So very impressive to see the growth of IPv6 there. And also very impressive to see the design of a website 10 years ago, because I have no time to update the design of the website there. But the information is updated every day.
Yeah, and if you want to go to Eric's website and find out what color your IPv6 address is, you can do that too. So you can reach the IPv6 Buzz podcast hosts on Twitter. Tom is at IPv6Tom. I'm at Scott Hoag. And Ed is at E. Horley, H-O-R-L-E-Y. We also have a at IPv6Buzz Twitter handle all set up too now. So if you wanted to reach out to us, ask us a question for a future listener question show, please do that. Thanks for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on packetpushers.net or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz. And also check out all the other great technical content over at Packet Pushers at packetpushers.net. So long, and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.